Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is another of the Distraction Pieces kind of rewind episodes. This one is from, when was it? It was from October 28th, 2015. And it's with Akala, who's, again, a rapper, an activist, a writer. His book, Natives, is all the more essential reading right now. But I think you'll enjoy this one. As said, if you missed the first one earlier, sorry, we did. Today was meant to be a drunk cast day. Recorded a great chat with Jade Adams and Rich Wilson and Chris and Stu, getting drunk and getting rowdy. And we do talk about everything that's going on. And it's, you know, it's a heavy drunk cast. It gets light as well. But for now, yeah, we wanted to keep it, just shine a light on some conversations that have come previously on the podcast that feel very relevant now. So yeah, this is the chat with Akala from 2015. And also, you may hear adverts on this podcast, but we will be making a donation higher than the amount we earn from these adverts to the causes that need the money right now. The one it looks like we're going to be supporting is the Minnesota Bail. Originally, it was going to be the Minnesota Bail Fund, but they've asked people, they've paused essentially donations because they're a small charity that suddenly had the world's focus on them. So if we can't donate to them, it will be someone similar to help this situation. Yeah, so apologies if the adverts feel inappropriate, but it's going to be a good cause that benefits from them and more. Yeah. As said, this is from 2015. It was episode 65 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, and it's with Akala. Just big love and respect to everyone who's fighting this all right now and previously. Yeah, hope you enjoy the chat. I've not got any big start or intro, so I'm joined by Akala. How you doing, man?
I'm not too bad at all. Yourself?
I'm good. And this has been one that the both of us have had requests for
for a while.
So it's good to put this on. And thanks for taking the time. As people have been messaging me about it, each time I'm like, yeah, we'll get around to it. Oh, you know, you always have a long list, a lot of requests. Yeah. And then I just keep seeing you doing more and more interviews and just killing it and more bits on shows. So I was like, it feels we need to make this happen now. So
it does indeed.
I'm pleased to get here. You've just got back from Zimbabwe.
I have indeed. Came back yesterday morning. I had a show in, a spoken word event in Birmingham last night.
Nice.
And then I had a workshop I was doing in East London today with a kind of young group of female artists, all women, actors, poets, writers, singers. So that was really interesting. But yeah, I got back from Zimbabwe at 5 a.m. yesterday morning.
Damn. And what were you doing in Zimbabwe? Were you working? Were you
I was working.
Scoping?
So it was like a scoping visit for a long-term collaboration with my company, the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company, and local organisations out there via the British Council.
It's one of the most distinctive and exciting things about what you're doing specifically is, I mean, we'll get onto all of it, but you're doing a lot of stuff in the arts that you're crossing over hip hop, you're crossing over spoken word, theatre, all sorts of performance. But what's really exciting is how much of it is translatable outside of the UK. So going and looking in Africa, going and looking in the Middle East, or any, you know, there's so many options where it seems to translate nicely. So yeah, so how is that? Like trying to think globally on each project rather than thinking, can we get booked in Greenwich? Do you know what I mean? It's like, we have to think the world on this.
It's really interesting. Even being in somewhere like Zimbabwe, you realise how much the internet has just changed the game.
Yeah.
I mean, walking down the street in Harare, it wasn't quite like being in London.
Yeah.
But, you know, every day, at least four or five people stopped me.
Yeah,
and knew
crazy.
Who I was and wanted photos and knew Fire in the Booth.
That's
and was
nuts,
like, I watched your London Real interview or whatever it was, right? So the internet has just completely changed the game. And it means as an artist, as a thinker, as a theatre practitioner, as any kind of person that does anything audio or visual, you have direct access to the people without the interference really of corporate bullshit, without the interference of a radio playlist person telling you they don't know where your song fits in, or it's not 3 minutes 45, it's about something other than girls and bikinis and walking to the shops, you know. So you have this really a brave new world out there, to coin a phrase. And actually, the travels I've done this year really show me that more than any previous year. I was in New York. That was like being in London. I went to Afropunk Festival and I was just shocked. Everybody at the festival knew me. It was photos every 2 minutes.
It's crazy,
Malcolm
isn't it?
Said it was
because it's the kind of thing that, again, 5-10 years ago, I had Roots Maneuver on a few weeks back, and he was saying how touring America was so hard because of him being the first real a UK rap act to be out there doing that. And now there's a lot there'd still be. You talk to a booking agent, and I guarantee you'd still, and this isn't any diss, but you'd have some booking agent going, well, I don't know if your profile's good enough, isn't that? Whereas if you were just to do it yourself with people who are hitting you up and all this, it's like, right, no, we can make this happen. Yeah. And I think that's a huge change in the industry at the moment.
I'm touring in Australia in December, same thing. And it's crazy, I've never been on a major label. I haven't had a Radio 1 playlist since 2005.
Yeah.
So it's literally 10 years since I had a daytime playlisted song.
Yeah.
In those 10 years, I've probably performed in at least 40 countries.
That's crazy.
And so that's partly that I think being an artist that talks about things that resonate globally means you pull in a particular kind of audience that stays with you, but also literally just the internet. I say this to young artists all the time. When I came in the game, and I'm not old, you know, we're talking 10 years ago.
Yeah.
There was no Facebook, there was no Twitter, there was no YouTube.
No,
if you wanted to be seen, you had to compete with big American record labels to get on MTV.
Yeah.
Which I did, you know, I lost a lot of money in the beginning of my career shooting big budget music videos try and get onto MTV, who was at the time wasn't playing any UK rappers. And then obviously Channel U came along.
I was going to say, that was it. You had the choice of keeping it real local, and I'm meaning dividing up London.
Absolutely.
Not just saying South, like really keeping it real local to make a name, or going that route of going, right, we're going to try and be a major label style act.
Absolutely.
And that's tough, man. It was tough then, it's tough now.
It was very tough. I mean, my aim was always to be independent, but was to compete at that level. And then as things evolved more and I found more who I was as an artist and I found more what I wanted to do and I thought more about creating something that was a bit more holistic, that had a one foot in theatre, that as we're moving forward has, you know, a foot in the TV world. We're working on a lot of projects in that space, kind of arts and culture space projects. That really was, has one foot in the literature world. I wrote a graphic novel, I wrote a book of poems, I'm working on some longer term stuff. Writing some play stuff. So I just kind of feel really blessed, actually, and really lucky. And part of it is just the time that I was born at. If I was born 20 years earlier and I had the same range of ideas and desires and dare I say it, talents, I wouldn't have had the opportunities I had.
Yeah.
So in many ways, we're just lucky to be born at a time when actually we can circumvent the traditional industry, even what you're doing with this podcast.
Well, that's
you can set up a couple of microphones and be like, bam.
And that's it. And it can go straight directly out to people. You don't have to be having a boss or going through a middleman or having things signed off or cleared. And there's no overseeing agenda. And again, I ramble about it online all the time about my excitement about the uprising of podcasts at the moment. Mm. But I genuinely think it's in that last election, everyone went on and on about how the media are portraying certain parties or the media are not covering the anti-austerity marches and things like that. It's like, that's your choice of media.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you can complain all you like about the media, but if there all this stuff is being covered, or if it's not, you can cover this shit now.
Yeah.
Even if it's on Twitter or on a blog or anything else, this can be covered and that can be got out there. So I think it's great because we're seeing people now being more proactive rather than just complaining about how the media is going, right, I reject that media. I reject that. I don't care about the tabloids. I care about, like, the Joe Rogan podcast in America gets like 2-3 million listeners every episode.
Exactly.
They're generally 3 hours long and he does a couple a week. That's a huge reach and
humongous.
Huge power. And yeah, again, it's that thing. It'll start to take away from that. And even things, as you said, like a fire in a booth. Yeah, they're BBC attached. But again, they're going out, they're just on the internet
as this
independent thing that can build and build.
But I mean, it's on the Beeb. But I mean, credit to Charlie, what he's been brave enough to do is to give the same platform to the complete range of voices within UK hip hop. Yeah. To have Loki and myself, quote unquote, the so-called conscious people,
yeah.
to have, and people have this misconception that those of us who are quote unquote conscious have something against those who are quote unquote not. My issue was always representation.
Yeah.
Hip hop is supposed to be, as Brother Ali put it, a complete plate.
Yeah.
You got starters, you got your main course, you got your dessert.
Completely.
I've got no issue. There should always be road rap. That's part of reality.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't have every rapper pretending they've sold crack and they shoot people because that's fake.
Yeah.
My thing is that should represent a small percentage because that's the reality in the ends, right? The vast majority of young boys growing up are working in JD Sports or going to college, or and those realities are valid. So for me, for what Charlie's done and what accounts for his success is having the Giggses of this world, the Stormzys of this world, and everything in between. Whoever else he's had, he's literally had a complete kind of range of the scene to, like I said, the people like me and the Lokis, the Lady Leashes, whoever else. He's had such a range of representation, unlike, say, Westwood, who went before him, who only wanted to have American artists on his show and would give UK hip-hop artists 10 minutes.
And then got killed by KRS-One.
KRS-One,
anyway, just coming in and saying,
so
like,
many people had beef
you're
him.
A joke. You're like saying exactly. to his face, and that was dope. And I'm really glad you've highlighted that because there's a US rapper on my label called B Dolan, who's very political, very active, and we've discussed before how awkward it can be that the fan base that you build often won't have that openness that you've just discussed there.
Yeah,
I'll post. A Lil Wayne song because I like a Lil Wayne song, and they'll be like,
"How
can't believe you posting
fake,
this?" But
it's Illuminati, like, blah blah blah.
It's like,
blah.
It's like
no,
dude,
man,
I like music. So there's room for everything. And like at my club night, I'm not playing that much conscious hip hop because I'm DJing at 1 a.m. and I'm drunk. I don't want to hear conscious.
It's bigger than hip hop. Dead Prez is a club song.
Epic Mensa, or Dead Prez or MOP, people like that. So people are saying shit, but still, I want to hear bangers.
Banging.
It's like,
I want to dance.
There's room for all of that
in
hip hop and in music.
This, I find this kind of judgmental, and I think people have got that mistake from me sometimes. I think questioning the promotion of violence and misogyny and all those things in hip hop is absolutely valid.
Yeah.
Pretending hip hop is different from other art forms and should be held to an exceptionally higher standard of morality than, say, Hollywood films, which do the same thing, glorify violence and misogyny and the mafia and the FBI and the CIA, who, dare I say, have probably done far more damage in this world than young boys in the hood. Why should hip-hop be held to a different standard? It's a global conversation that affects all forms of art, and that's not me passing the buck. It's just me saying, I grew up and I love DMX and Mobb Deep, and I'm not going to apologise for that now because I'm 31, and maybe I don't play that music every day. At 15, that's what I loved. So it'd be very judgmental and backwards of me to act like I don't now understand why 15-year-old boys, particularly in difficult environments, and girls, love the equivalents.
Yeah,
for me,
completely.
DMX was creative. He was an artist. He was brilliant. It might have been very negative, but if you look at his life, what do you expect?
Exactly, and people forget as well that you've every right to be offended, but also that isn't a reason for something to not exist.
Exactly,
like that. This particular thing offends me personally. Yeah. It's like, cool, and you're right, and you're right to discuss that,
absolutely.
To debate that. That doesn't mean it shouldn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
It's still a valid.
If we take The Merchant of Venice, the way Shakespeare describes Jewish people in that play, in today's language, is offensive. There's no way around it. That today would be considered a racist play.
Yeah.
But does that mean Shakespeare's not a genius? Because he wrote a play that was... I mean, there's no way around it. It's a racist play.
Yeah.
You know, all the stereotypes and tropes and even the language it's used to describe Shylock is offensive. Ira Aldridge, actually, a famous African-American actor in the 1880s, he performed that play, but he in Russia, but he edited the text. He refused to perform it as it was because he was like, I don't want to perform it that way. We need to edit it because it's racist, basically.
Yeah.
So, which is just an interesting anecdote. But
it's completely true. You look along a most religious texts as well.
Yeah,
there'll be areas in it.
Conversion of slavery, murder, kill the neighbour, bury their babies, you know, all kind of madness.
And again,
does
that
mean that
black
and white
then of either saying, oh, therefore they're all evil. Again, I've got this same stance on religion. I'm not a religious person. I think there's been a lot of harm done by different religions, but there's been a lot of good done by different religions as well. So it's like,
it's how people
as long as it's not being
forced
upon me, it's like, you do you. And, you know, that's all good,
right? There's been a lot of good done by science. There's also been a lot of harm, you know? And what I find fascinating, this new snobbery towards religion, I find really dangerous in a way that it's almost like being religious is considered the old form of being a savage. What do I mean by that? No one ever calls a physicist and says, can you explain why the nuclear bomb was made?
Yeah.
Or why
yeah.
machine guns were made? You know, yeah. science is inherently violent. You must defend science. Science is a tool, and it can be used to promote violence. It has done. It can be used to create weapons of mass destruction
Completely.
And murder. Religion, similarly. If for me, as a person that isn't traditionally religious in an Abrahamic sense, I look at the spread of religion and the violence attached to it and the slavery justified by it, but then I also have to look at the converse and all the millions of people throughout the world who found it within their hearts, within their religious beliefs, to find inspirations of love
yeah.
and inspirations for revolution even. Inspiration. Yeah. I mean, Marcus Garvey and the Ku Klux Klan had the same religion.
It's
you know,
crazy,
Harriet
right?
Tubman and the yeah. Ku Klux Klan had the same religion.
Yeah.
You know, how is that the case? That's how open-ended most of these books are, that
Completely.
Someone can take slavery and racism from the same thing and someone else can take revolution from it.
And
of course, in the Islamic world, where we are, which is the main dialogue of religion at the moment, we have that same level of nuance.
Yeah.
We have Sufis and we have all these religious traditions that have been used to spread peace, that have been used to spread a message of acceptance. And then, of course, like in any part system anywhere in the world, you have lunatics. The difference is those lunatics are held up as representative of 1.6 billion people on this planet. And it shouldn't take common sense to explain that those lunatics are about as representative of all Muslims as the KKK are of all Christians. They
yeah,
exist, yeah, no doubt about
yeah,
it.
It's bizarre that it does have to be explained. I remember all the demand for people for, you know, different figureheads of Muslim society to apologise for certain things when there have been these recent atrocities. It's like,
what's
that's
it got to
such
do with
a dumb thing?
Someone from Algeria, that someone
yeah.
from Saudi Arabia killed someone.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's completely tying together these individual things, these small likenesses. It's like saying, oh, that guy was also 6'3", so I want all 6'3" people
yeah.
to apologise
for
his
what
actions.
That person,
you know, it's not there's it's not
what,
causation.
What's
you know?
Dangerous about it is, we live in a world where, sadly, political illiteracy is so high. That let's take 9/11 and its aftermath, and let's go with the official story for a minute.
Yeah.
We won't get into anything else. 19 guys, if you roll with the official story, from Saudi Arabia commit
yeah.
an atrocity. Saudi Arabia, of course, is an American and British ally.
Yeah.
No one doubts that. And Iraq, who doesn't get along with Saudi Arabia, who has no connection to Al-Qaeda whatsoever, and everyone accepts that, can be made to pay for it, because
yeah.
in the world's imagination, well, you're all Muslim and you're all a bit brown, so somehow, even though it's our ally where the terrorists in this case came from, even in the official explanation, some other country can be made to pay. And that's the danger of tying together such large swathes of people based on race or religion or belief system. I mean, it's like something happened in Russia and people saying, you know, Sweden can pay for that, you know.
Yeah.
You're all white,
I mean,
so no big deal.
It's a lack of education, right?
It's
a lack of understanding outside of... and. England and America are probably the worst for this. And I heard someone the other day describe England as the America of Europe, which I thought was great, because we
are.
Yeah. We are.
In some ways, yeah.
We're
yeah,
so
sure.
in our own world in many ways. So even education on geography, that's just the
yeah.
simplicity of what you were saying there. Because to be honest, at the time, I didn't really know who was aligned with who was...
Yeah, for sure.
So it wasn't until I
and
looked
we
into it, which I chose
yeah.
to look
yeah,
into
absolutely.
It, but it wasn't until I looked into it that I was like... Right, so why are they going after Iraq? Why
yeah, what's
they,
he got to do with that?
Why
yeah, exactly.
You know, where's the tie in here? But yeah. it's a fundamental problem in our educational systems then, right?
Well,
on learning more globally rather than here's what happened in England 500 years ago, 600 years, you know, everything else.
Which is,
instead of looking at here's what's happened in different parts of the world mm. in the last 100 years.
My thing is
know?
Also, even what we learn about England, England
yeah.
has, like any part of the human... world, progressive, revolutionary, for want of a better word, socialist-leaning traditions that were
yeah.
about sharing, anti-slavery, that were anti-privatisation of land, going all the way back to the Peasants' Revolt, to the Levellers, the Diggers, Thomas Spence, Thomas Paine. England has those traditions.
Yeah.
The massacre at Peterloo. What I find fascinating is that imperial success, if we can call it success, has brainwashed a lot of people into identifying with symbols of oppression, including Henry VIII, who killed thousands of poor people. We're taught divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. We're not taught that he murdered lots of poor people just because it's fun and it's Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very fascinating. Even what we learn about England is tempered by a particular view of who is English and who represents the country.
Yeah.
And what constitutes English history. When I was much younger and I studied much less world history, I used to feel like only black people had been written out of world history. Which, of course, the extremity to which Africa has been written out of the human story is probably the most extreme. But to different degrees around the world, women, poor people, people who are political dissidents are written out of the national story, even if they fundamentally shaped that given country.
I mean, it's easy to overlook that it's far more prevalent as a class thing rather than as a race or sex thing. And so that at points, women were a lower class. At points, certain races were a lower class, and it's therefore class that can often be the thing that actually unifies them as who are written out and who are ignored.
Well, I think the two things are not mutually exclusive, or the three things. I think class, race and gender function as a matrix altogether.
Yeah.
And I don't think one predominates the other. I think they interact in a way that is quite insidious, because, for example, you can be a wealthy person. I was just in Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
If the wealthy class in Zimbabwe around the world are invisible because of where they are in the world. They're in Black Africa. There's a perception of how they live based on racial ideology that has nothing to do with their reality. They drive Mercedes. They live like rich people everywhere else. Yeah. They eat at the ice cream parlour. They go to the shopping mall. They live in nice, huge houses with massive farms. Like, life for rich people in Zimbabwe and in most of Africa is fantastic, just like life is for rich people, at least materially. And so our racial assumptions based on kind of mistaught history can still exist and go against the grain of class, just in the same way that poor people can be made to hate the other in the way that when we came here as Caribbeans, there was a lot of physical violence and resistance. And even now we're seeing this year, which has been one of the saddest things of this year for me, Black South Africans murdering other African immigrants coming into their country on the grounds of sounding like racist, what we would quote-unquote see as being racist white people, coming here, taking our jobs, blah, blah, blah. We had a Zulu king come out and diss all these other Africans that were coming. About 60 people were murdered. Might have even been more than that. I mean, there was a massive... And given that South Africa inspired the world with its anti-racist struggle, given that other African nations lent help to that anti-apartheid struggle, to me, seeing that level of kind of virulent anti-black racism coming from other black people was part of the legacy of apartheid, but also just of human weakness. It was kind of really humbling. You know, you look at the world and you think, this kind of gargantuan set of problems that we have, it can be overawing sometimes.
Yeah. Do you think that in some ways comes back round to the ability to take on certain traits or overwhelming notions because of the internet now? So that general feeling now around a lot of the world that you're seeing of immigrants are bad, immigration bad, which is crazy when you think of literally every country is built on immigration. Literally every country. Yeah. So you're saying that immigration from now is bad.
Only, let's be clear. I mean, we're in Kensington and Chelsea. We are in the wealthiest borough in Britain right now, which also has a lot of poverty in it. I point that out because there's a whole bunch of Islamic immigrants just south of this borough that are billionaires. That's not who we're talking about when we say migration, right? This is what I mean about race and class.
Yeah.
Right? When we talk about Muslims migrating here, who have we got an issue with? It's not Muslim billionaires from oil-rich Gulf states who buy Ferraris and McLarens and keep all the hotels in Kensington and Knightsbridge full. Yeah. We haven't got an issue with those people. No. So even though they're the quote-unquote wrong religion, even though they're the quote-unquote wrong race, their money and their allegiance to the British elite means that they're not a problem. It's not those immigrants we mean. It's the poor people. It's people that are perceived to be... And even if those rich people, many of their elites can be proved to be allied to certain ideologies and funding certain dangerous ideologies, doesn't matter as long as they keep the oil flowing and keep the money in the right people's back pockets.
I mean, the scariest part for me is the immigrants that the majority of the UK who are against immigration are against are fictional immigrants. They're immigrants that aren't real people. They're these versions of them that you've read about and heard these fear-mongering stories about. So it's crazy that there's such an uproar over, again, a fictional thing. And again, not to keep coming back to it, but surely that comes down to greater education.
Comes down to greater education, and you're right, it comes down to...
Or providing of information, at least. Yeah. It's both the things we talked about, in fact, education and a freer, more open and accurate media, rather than we can say what we want and then it'll be read, and then we can rescind some of it down the line if it wasn't quite right, you know, but that's not going to be paid attention to.
I think the sad thing is, whether we like it or not, the mainstream media isn't going anywhere, and people are not going to turn off those channels. So I think we have to, as people involved in alternative media, we have to create our own platforms.
Yeah.
And, where possible, interact with and engage with putting different information on those popular platforms. And all of the uproar around immigration this year has, and during the election, is really just about distracting us from the problems of this society. Yeah. And that the ruling elite of this society, like ruling elites in most societies, have displayed immense corruption. You're giving 700 billion or whatever the number was to their mates who ruined the economy, privatising everything from here to kingdom come, creating all sorts of problems within the society that are totally unnecessary. Britain is a very wealthy society, has more than enough money to feed, clothe, house, educate, provide healthcare for every single person in this country many times over.
More than... And that's something that has to be made clear when people respond to immigration with things like, well, once we've sorted out our own homeless issues or our own things, then we can start thinking about the rest of the world. It's like, well, no, that's stuff that we can. That's stuff that's in the budgets and in the cash flow of the country.
And the problem with that isn't people coming here. A, B, most of the people that have come here skilled, qualified. I mean, we've got to make up our mind. If we don't like immigrants, then we shouldn't use the NHS because it was built by immigrants. You know, make up your mind. 100%. And I'm fine with it. If you don't like immigrants, then die instead of letting the Bangladeshi woman or the Ghanaian woman.
There's a Doug Stanhope bit where he's saying about how particularly in America, the nearer to Mexico you get, the more there's people saying, these people coming over, they can't even speak the language, they can't even do the basic things. And then they also say they're stealing our jobs. It's like, if you're losing your job to someone who can't even speak the language, if you're putting this person down, if in your mind the people coming over here are such a drain on society, then if they're stealing your jobs, then you need to up your fucking game, really. Yeah. You know, it's not, you can't have both of them.
They can't be completely useless, lazy welfare claimants.
You need to pick your fiction.
And also having jobs. Like, at least if you're going to go with a stereotype, be consistent.
Yeah.
But I mean, also the hypocrisy, particularly for Britain, is the amount of British people living abroad runs well into the millions. B, the history of this country founding settler colonial states in South Africa, in Kenya, in Zimbabwe, in Australia, in America. All of those descendants still live there, some of whom are direct, like when I was in Zimbabwe, there's over a million people of British descent in Zimbabwe still, all of whom are quite wealthy, despite what people want to tell you, all of whom live very well, despite how people want to portray it. That's why they haven't come back. And so we've got to make up our mind, you know, we can't act like this kind of small, victimised, tiny little island when this country was the first global empire in the history of humanity. Make up your mind. Britain had 52 countries, I've said this before, that it claimed to be the mother of. It was the mother country of the British Commonwealth. And the vast majority of the people who've immigrated into this country are from the British Commonwealth. The recent waves of immigration, we've got to make up our mind. Either we love Syrians so much that we want to militarily intervene to save them from their supposed... And I don't know enough about Syrian politics. I'm not saying Assad is or isn't a bad or good guy, because I would like to look into it for myself. I haven't done that in the case of Syria enough to make the comment. The point is, if we are willing to muster the military might of the British armed forces to save these people, because we love them, apparently, yet we don't want them in our country. So if the truth is there's some British strategic interest to protect there, don't insult the British public. Say, look, oil region, or you know, we're against Iran and blah, blah, blah. Whatever it is that is the strategic interest, just be honest with the British public, which is obviously not going to happen. Yeah. Just say these are the reasons we think we should deploy military force. But it's not because we love Syrians, otherwise we'd be welcoming them into the country. Incidentally, we also, a lot of people like to forget this today, during Nazi Germany, Britain also refused to take a lot of Jewish people and described them, in particularly the Daily Mail, in remarkably similar ways to the way that we're describing people coming from Syria today. So people's memory is so short today because there is a genuine respect for the Holocaust as a particularly horrific event. No one wants to look back and admit Britain refused to take a lot of those migrants, but that is what happened. And so I feel like the British elite has learned nothing. Most ordinary people are decent people, I believe. And the reason why I can prove that is if you look even where UKIP received all their votes, it was in all the places there's no immigrants. So what does it tell you? All the people that don't know any immigrants are the ones that hate them. There's like an inverse map, and it's an inverse to where the populations of immigration are high and where UKIP got their votes, and it's all
completely
in all the populations.
And it's fascinating as well, because it does not to be... unnecessarily kind of goading or disrespectful to your UKIPs and things like that. But that fact just tells you that generally they are that bit further in the past, you know, in areas where immigration, where in the 70s and 80s, where African families came into South London, came into the Midlands, Asian families into the all over the country, they're not the areas that have this issue because they've got to know this, they've seen this, they've built, they've grown. Whereas now that that's happening and spreading out, it's taken, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. Now that's starting to happen, they're having the same fears that London had all them years ago.
You ain't got to tell me.
You know, and it turned out all right. it turned out affluent and really helped society.
In many ways, London, for all its faults, I'm not going to pretend London is a paradise because it isn't. But in many ways, it is a model, quite a remarkable model, not because of the British elite, I would say in spite of them, particularly in working class London. I grew up in North London, Archway, Holloway, around there. My neighbourhood had kids from Somalia, India, Cyprus, Ireland, Turkey, Jamaica, Ghana, working class white English. Even we had actually a lot of kind of middle and upper class kids, and in a weird way. You know, I'm not... Race was there, you know. We, particularly in primary school, it didn't matter so much. In secondary school, we did become stratified by race because of experience. All the young black boys started hanging around together because of the way teachers stereotyped us and because of getting searched by the police. And certain experiences socialise you into particular groups. But we still all kind of interacted. And the main tension was not race. Black boys were not fighting with Asian boys. In fact, Asian boys were fighting each other, the white boys were fighting each other, and the black boys were fighting each other. It was almost like the violence was segregated in groups. And there was some cross-cultural violence, but most of it was not based around race anymore. And so it's a really interesting new culture. If you look at young people in London today, again, I'm not saying it's a utopia, but I'd say to a remarkable degree, more than probably any other place on the planet, there is such a diverse range of people living next to each other in relative peace.
Yeah.
And that is quite fascinating about London as a model. And actually, it makes me very proud of the city. Even if I don't feel totally British or English, I feel very much like a Londoner, and I feel very much like this city has shaped me and who I am, and I wouldn't have had the experiences I've had and the interaction I've had with Cypriot culture or Gujarati culture or Turkish people or Irish people anywhere else in the world, while still remaining a proudness of who I am and what I am. And so in many ways, London is very unique and very amazing, and it seems current policy is trying to destroy all of that. They're pushing out all the poor people.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be down to, again, you've got to... A look back at when we were this, that's the benefit, or when it was first acceptable, of when we were this great empire, supposedly, because we're going to all these places and saying how great Britain
is. You've gone around the world.
It's amazing. You've got to tell everyone that Britain's amazing.
And people are like, safe, I want to come.
And then a few years later, you're like, well, it's not for you. It's like, no.
And the funny thing is, even this mythology that Britain was once this homogenous place, when? We can go back to the Industrial Revolution. And even then, conditions for workers were so bad in London that every year they had to replenish the working population with immigrants. Immigrants from Eastern Europe, immigrants from Ireland, immigrants from all over the world. Granted, in many cases, most of those immigrants were quote-unquote European and what we today would call white. Nonetheless, immigration on an island has been constant. So I think most of the people that would probably listen to someone like yourself already kind of know that. And that's the shame, is that we're preaching to the converted. What hasn't been done is there hasn't been a comprehensive show just laying out the facts, very simply. Not just of Britain, but of the history of the movement of peoples around the world, which has obviously been a constant ever since the Ethiopian Australopithecus called Dinkonesh, that they call Lucy, to quote my friend Annie Anaxaguru. You know, people have been migrating forever.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's...
xenophobia ain't going to stop
it's, that. It's great. Just speaking there of preaching to the converted, I had some guests on from a website called Full Fact. org, who now have their own podcast as well, and what I like about them is they go through, they'll look at Britain First posts and they'll look at the stats quoted and they'll go and analyse them and give the correct stats. But the thing I like about them is they will do the same for left wing posts or propaganda or things like that aren't accurate. And that's the exciting thing there is finding more, or I guess the internet provided a platform to say, right, are we going to be unbiased? We're going to be as critical and as stringent on the stuff that we support.
Agree with. Yeah, absolutely.
As well as the stuff that we're against, you know?
Just because we politically agree with something is no excuse for shoddy scholarship. Yeah. If I quote something and I'm mistaken, I want people to correct me on that.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And say, actually, have you checked out this? Just because you might agree broadly with the political point, there's no reason to not be specific and not to correct. Actually, that was inaccurate. That was inaccurate. Actually, there's new data around that. For example, I found out something yesterday I didn't really know. I mean, I've been studying African history for a very long time. And not that this is an inaccuracy, but it's just something that really fascinated me. I thought, wow, how could I not know that? And I've been studying this history for like 15 years. Yeah. I found out that there was an indigenous West African smallpox inoculation, and that the vast majority, almost all of the West Africans, were inoculated against smallpox before they were enslaved in the Americas, which is why smallpox did not have the effect on the African population
that had
on indigenous Americans. And this is known today. I mean,
that's
so
crazy.
Right. Yeah. Now, I've been studying this history 15, 20 years, and I didn't know that. So it's really, shout out to Robin Walker, who's the scholar whose book I read that was in.
Yeah.
And for people who want it, I will tweet the book link and they can go in and check that out. But what I find, one of the things that's so great about the world today and the internet is this access to such a broad plethora of information, this ability to fact-check very quickly. Obviously, it's another platform for spreading bullshit too.
Yeah.
But hey, you know, bullshit's always existed, and just because I'm into a particular set of things doesn't mean I can kind of get morally uptight.
But
and be
as
like,
I said, it's the ability to fact-check that bit easier, and still so many people won't, and that's something that we just have to deal with. I mean, an illustration of that I often use is people will tweet me asking when my next gig in Birmingham is, or something like that.
When it's
like,
blatantly it's listed,
like,
right?
Or just like, you're on the internet.
Yeah.
Like, you can find that out. Yeah, like, you can find that out in a second.
They just want to make
conversation. Google it. Yeah. You can do it. But again, it's that same thing. I've been guilty of it in the past. It's far easier to read something that makes your blood boil and repost it. Whereas now, you can read something that makes your blood boil, quickly do a quick search of fact-checking it or debunking or demystifying or whatever. And there's pages that do that, just go, right, here's the facts about it. Like, again, a McDonald's are a great example of that. Mm. I don't eat at McDonald's.
Me neither. I haven't eaten meat for 9 years.
As much as anything, I'm not a fan of the taste, but they're clearly not a great company. But they're one of the companies I end up arguing with people almost in favour of the most, because there's so much bullshit out there about them that's so easy to debunk that people believe anything. If you did a post saying most of the burgers are made from horse meat and I've had these facts, millions of people would push it out there just believing it as fact. So again, it's that thing of checking, being as stringent on what you believe in or what supports your beliefs.
Yeah, there's enough wrong with McDonald's
exactly
that you can just put, this is what's wrong with them and this is and
exactly
this is
what. I think it's about being I've always been obsessed with, it's completely right to be passionate and have strength and conviction in your beliefs, but not to be married to them to the extent you can't be educated on them or learn more. And that's, you know, it shouldn't be a shameful thing for someone to say, you're wrong, actually. Here's why.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that should be something that you're craving and looking for.
Yeah,
let's talk a little bit about the general British a reaction to things then, our way. I mean, we've talked a lot about the ruling classes, essentially, and I think it saddens me at point how little we're willing to do to back against them, whereas you look at places like France, example I often give. I loved it in France when they tried to bring clamping in, and the French people didn't agree with it. So as one, any time there was a clamp, they'd put glue in it, so it had to be broken to be taken off. They stopped clamping. They acted as a community to say, we don't accept this from the government. Now, my only thinking on that is we have a history, or the history we're taught is of the elite conquering and making us great, the great in Great Britain being the kings and the queens, not the people. Whereas places like France, their history is social revolution, is the people.
Even though they had
up.
An empire of the same scale.
Yeah, exactly.
They've come to define themselves.
But the bits that's no more is when the people have come up and said, right, we're not going to take this anymore. So what do you think we need to do to make the UK take more responsibility, or say, right, if we're not happy with this, for example, if we're not happy with the way our electoral system works, in my mind, it's crazy that we in general go, right, well, next election, I'm going to vote against that. You know, I'm not saying that that's the wrong thing to do. I'm saying surely there's more immediate or more direct ways to address your issues or discontent.
Politics is all day, every day, and I think we have been lulled into a sense of laziness. by celebrity culture. I think we have been lulled into a lack of education about the way in which the hard-fought freedoms, limited freedoms that we have, were won. So most people think that poor people have the right to vote or to go on holiday or to not live in Victorian slums because of the enlightenment of the ruling classes, when actually every single freedom that people have in this country was hard fought and won, usually by the shed of blood. And I can prove that. We can go through it. Like I said, some of the things I mentioned earlier, from the Peterloo Massacre, which was a march of parliamentary reform, in which 15 unarmed protesters were hacked to death by the yeomanry and military constabulary up in St. Peter's in Manchester. But not long after, parliamentary reform came because of this consistent, determined waves of resistance to a lack of democracy.
It's very much a myth, an easy line to say violence never solved anything. And again, I'm not saying that violence is the only answer, but violence has been a very powerful tool throughout history. And again, it's not always, if there's a peaceful solution, fucking brilliant. That's great news. But
love it.
There's not always a peaceful.
Well, I mean, I'm
solution.
From
you look at people like Mandela or all these many other people where there was some violence involved there as well. But generally, when you look at the peaceful side of it, took years and years in prison, and you know all these other things, rather than
and even then, I mean, many people would argue Mandela didn't defeat apartheid; he defeated political apartheid.
Yeah.
But the white settler colony that is South Africa is all of the wealth, all of the banks, most of the land, everything that was owned by the same people before apartheid is still owned by most of the same people after. So he got rid of political apartheid, which is a fantastic achievement.
It's huge,
you know? But it isn't the whole story. My family's from Jamaica, my dad's family. So for me, you know, something, an institution as unjust as slavery, people want to pretend it came to an end because of William Wilberforce, you know, petition in Parliament. Abolitionism is part of the story. Meanwhile, in Jamaica, Sam Sharp and Paul Bogle and the Maroons were burning down half of the island.
Yeah.
We're chopping up slave masters, making slavery untenable. We literally destroyed the entire infrastructure to have slavery in Jamaica. It's not a coincidence that it was then abolished a couple of years later.
Yeah.
So it's, I wish, like you said, it would be wonderful if there was always a peaceful solution, and things like clamping can be solved in that way. And there are groups that do things like that, but it needs to be a more sustained campaign. Incidentally, from my understanding, and someone can correct me on this if they hear this when I'm wrong, because I haven't fully fact-checked this, but I was told this by a traffic warden in Scotland, that they don't allow private companies in Scotland to profit from clamping and tickets.
Because
basically, she didn't give me a ticket. And I was wondering why. I was like, why didn't you give me a ticket? I was in the shop for like 20 minutes trying to get change, and I just got carried away. I was like, oh, we don't make any money. We don't make commission. There are no private companies up here. And our motivation is to keep traffic moving. Yeah. Our motivation isn't to make money. And so with things like that, I've seen these people take the cars of a pregnant mother with four children when she's on the school run on the way home because she's got some unpaid tickets. I mean, to me, how you can have that happening. Even for me. Now, I take it, you know, maybe I'm lucky I can afford to pay the fines or whatever else. I'm not saying I'm rich, but, you know, I don't have any children and I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
I've been in a situation where I've got a ticket for 40 quid and I've missed it. I'm crap at opening my letters.
Yeah.
6 months later, the bloody thing's 700-800 quid.
Yeah.
How can something go from £40 to 700? And then bailiff will come and knock on your door and you think, well, this has got to be illegal. You know, the guy's tried to take my car for a ticket that has started off as £40. I mean, who gives these people permission to do stuff like that?
Not to go off track, but I'm going through exactly the same thing at the moment because I moved recently and I've just had a letter forwarded on from my old place from a month or two ago saying you owe £40. That's now gone up to £200-300. And I'm saying, I don't think that's just.
No,
you know, I've not dodged or avoided this. I changed my address and it wasn't put through in some way. I've got proof of this. So, again, it's that thing of...
I can't claim that I didn't know. I literally just don't open my post.
It's still injustice that I would... Again, it's that thing of... Again, it's lucky to be in a situation where, again, I'm not wealthy, but...
You're doing all right.
Whatever happens, I'm doing all right. I would rather go to court to argue that, to say that I think it's unjust, to say that for no further expense, it's now gone up at this much.
Possible.
And I mean, there's nothing to justify this extra money.
No,
has passed.
Yeah, that's it.
Time has passed, therefore...
It's a tax on days.
Right, in that case, then we can say, let's forget that time passed and go back to what the original offence was and deal with... You know, I'd rather morally go and argue that and then pay whatever the hell I have to pay, then just go, all right, well, because you're scaremongering it and saying bailiffs and all this other shit, it's like, oh, I'll put my hands up and say that's acceptable, you know?
And it's also, I mean, but back to your question, I suppose, what do we do to change the culture? And I think it is changing. I think this generation, and maybe it's just me being naive, I'm seeing more political activism. I'm seeing people becoming awake. I'm seeing more interest in history. I'm seeing people realising that actually the situation in the country is getting quite serious. There is a massive push to the right. I mean, I read in the news day before yesterday that the Conservatives have just said they're going to build a prison in Jamaica, £25 million, they're building a prison in Jamaica to send back all of the Jamaican criminals to Jamaica. And because of all the scaremongering, even I thought there were more Jamaican criminals in the UK prisons than there really are.
Yeah.
You know how many people it is? It's 700 people.
That's crazy, right? Isn't it?
And there are more Irish and more Polish in Britain's prisons than there are Jamaicans. There are over 10,000 foreign nationals in Britain's prisons.
Yeah.
This is all according to the Daily Mail. So this is the most right-wing statistics available.
Yeah,
still they even had to admit, well, why aren't we sending back the Irish? Oh, because we've got a special relationship with them. Why aren't we sending back the Polish? Oh, because their prisons are already full. So I can't help but cynically think, is this the first step towards sending back British-born people of Jamaican origin?
Yeah.
Because what else could be the motivation for Britain to spend £25 million in a recession, supposedly, on building a prison in a foreign British Commonwealth country? And so I think with this type of George Osborne saying he's going to get rid of free school meals, as someone who grew up on free school meals,
100%.
I'm like, hold on a minute. Like, what you're saying is you want people to starve.
Yeah.
Because there are literally children in this country, through no fault of their own, who are born into families who don't have money, who will not eat if there are no free school meals.
Yeah.
How do you expect a child to learn if there are no free school meals? What you're saying is you want this child to go on the street.
Yeah.
Because if I'm not eating breakfast and my only chance for a meal is at school, and school's no longer providing free school meals, and I'm hungry and I'm 14, what am I going to do at that point? Oh, and the local drug dealer's saying, yo fam, you can make £200 a day, you know? All you've got to do is X, Y, and Z. If it's a choice between that and not, oh, is that what we're saying? They're actually trying to turn poverty in this country.
I mean, it's
back 100 years.
It feels like it harks again to our obsession with American culture in many ways,
because America's
had that for so long of turning the ghettos into
real ghettos.
What they are. This was just an area where poor people live. We'll demonise it enough and put enough restrictions on that. Yeah, that is now an area that you don't want to go at night, because there are drug dealers and there are this and all that. It's like, that's not through choice in many situations. Yeah. That's not through choice. That's through the forcing of circumstance and situation onto
these. I'll give you a specific example. Compton, probably the most famous ghetto in America, was a middle-class neighbourhood in the 60s. A lot of people don't know this. That's why it looks so nice. Originally, it was a middle-class white neighbourhood. Then loads of black population, socially, upperly mobile black population started to move in. It became an all-black neighbourhood, still middle-class, because most of the black population in Compton worked at two huge car factories that were in the area. I think one was Chrysler, one was Ford. But don't quote me on that part of it. There were two huge car factories. Everyone worked there. Those car factories closed down. Overnight, Compton went from 80% employment to 80% unemployment.
Yeah.
And that's when the gangs came in. That's when the poverty... So literally the same people who before were willing to work hard, had nice middle class lives, you know, et cetera, et cetera, stable neighborhood, low rates of violence.
Circumstance. Yeah. You can't put that down to anything intrinsic
now,
in their
character. Maybe now people are making choices. Some people get out of the hood, however we want to cut it. The fact is, a decision to outsource work to Asia because it was cheaper, because bottom line made more profit, had consequences, very real consequences for poor neighborhoods all across the country. And that was part of design policy. Even the way they design, if you want to find, because in America poverty is so racialized, if you want to find the black neighborhood in any American city, just look for where the freeway is. Because in the 60s, during a period called urban renewal, aka also known as nigger removal, they built motorways over all of the black neighborhoods so that people didn't have to drive through them, so there wouldn't no commerce would be created. So the Bronx is like that. There's a freeway that comes from outside in the suburbs into Manhattan. In Chicago it's like that. In LA it's like that. And so you have these kind of isolated islands that are an outcome of policy. France has the same. And it seems that England will not be satisfied, or at least certain factions of the British elite will not be satisfied, until we go from being one of the most multicultural, one of the most diverse, one of the most peaceful major cities of that kind of range of population and range of income, and really culturally interesting, into an ethnically homogenous, wealthy, with of course its touch of Russian, Middle Eastern, African, Indian billionaires, of course, because we'll never get rid of those. We're always happy to be multicultural when it's wealth. And we want to go on that kind of Parisian model. Again, what do? I believe we use forms of alternative media. I believe we use forms of resistance. I believe, I mean, there's like that, I can't remember the, was it E15 Project? the young mums in East London who occupied the housing estate there. I believe we engage in efforts like that. I believe from really positive thing I saw, there's these immigration enforcement vans going around, you know, randomly pulling over people and trying to send them, quote unquote, back to where they came from. I saw a really inspiring picture from Shadwell where the local boys had cut the tyres of these vans. I'm not even going to complain about that. I'm not upset by it. I think you have to have forms of resistance that occupy many different spaces, from education to physically being present, to marching, to organising yourself in the way you speak daily. But I don't think we should give up the current gains, limited gains that we have without any kind of a fight.
I think it comes back to something you said earlier that's great, that the politics is a day-to-day thing.
Absolutely.
And I think around the time of the election, you saw far more of these campaigns being supported. The mums and all the different things that were people being active to show this. And then as the election came around, it didn't go the way a lot of people wanted. Quite understandably, a lot of people were disheartened and were like, "Oh, it's not worked." Or it's like, I think the thing that we we're learning to be a politically active society.
Yeah,
and I think one of the essential things to learn is a lot of the times you're not necessarily fighting to win. You're fighting because it's something that's worth fighting for.
Yeah,
you know, the winning should be an end goal, but you shouldn't go, "Oh, the election didn't go the way we want, therefore we should stop." It's like, right, well, that means you have to fight all the harder, and there should be more support and more actions.
Well, I think also there wasn't a credible, viable, in my view, progressive alternative in the last election, whereas in Scotland there was, and everyone voted for it.
Yeah.
So I think now in the UK, even though I'll never be a supporter of the Labour Party, having someone like Jeremy Corbyn there offering look at the way they're portraying the guy in the media. You'd think the guy was bloody Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
The way they're talking about him, which is fascinating for a guy preaching peace to kind of be put across as this kind of out of touch, slightly crazy, eccentric. It just shows you how out of touch the people who are.
A danger to British community and society.
Because he's not willing to bomb random people around the country.
What the Prime Minister has said, that he's a danger.
He's a threat to national security.
It's hilarious,
But now it means that there is, even within the confines, I'm not going to overinflate the degree to which someone within party politics can change a country, because I'm not that naive about the way things work. But there is now something that is qualitatively different in a mainstream space. Tony Blair and David Cameron, I mean, it's apples and oranges.
Yeah, completely.
Right? Whereas, obviously, someone like Corbyn, unlike David Cameron, who wanted to hang Nelson Mandela, I do believe, Jeremy Corbyn was an active anti-apartheid activist in the 80s. He has a good record of being progressive in many ways. And again, I don't support the Labour Party, but I understand now that what we can see is the manifestation in party political terms of that alternative idea. That doesn't mean people should just give up and just go and vote for the guy that they like. You still have to organise. You still have to be educated. You still have to continually, if what you believe in is a freer, fairer, more caring, more loving society, that's something you have to try and practice on a daily basis and push forward on a daily basis. Because the people who want everything for themselves are going to continually fight for it on a daily basis.
Yeah, completely. I mean, how do you feel then, to play, not even devil's advocate here, with a greater arising of a genuine choice on the left that is different from the other parties, with Corbyn, with numerous others? In that case, my argument has always been, I think that UKIP are the biggest bunch of I don't want to start throwing names about, but I feel most of their points, if you discuss them and have facts there, they can be broken down.
They're
a
indefensible,
lot.
So again,
but equally, I feel if there's a percentage of society that thinks that way, then they need to be represented in this argument, in this fight for power, and they're as important. Even though,
I might disagree with them, but if that's
even
how
though
they
if
feel,
I had an
right
option to say they're gone, the fact is there's a portion of
society. Democracy
that
doesn't mean
that
you get your
that,
way all the time.
Exactly, and that's the thing that I think people. I'm personally, and again, I don't talk about my political beliefs too much because I feel they can be a hugely personal thing. You know, I'm not Russell Brand. I love Russell, but I don't feel an urge to convince everyone of my way of thinking. Yeah. My problem is I don't support our current form of democracy.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. The thing that was ironic to me in many ways of a lot of my left-leaning friends in the last election, mm-hmm. where they were all hugely excited, but then when they didn't get their way, working within the current form of democracy, they all, to say threw their toys out the pram is almost incendiary, but they were all very unhappy. It's like, well,
the whole premise is
for me, you should have had that anger before it. Yeah, you can't get angry just because it didn't go the way you wanted. It's fine, and because I am, it's fine to be against our current democratic system, our forms of voting, our representation, mm-hmm. all of that. Mm-hmm. But it irks me somewhat when you're happy to go along in that when you thought you might get your way, but then when you don't get your way, you're then angry about it. It should be a thing that you should remain angry about. This shouldn't be a oh shit, the Tories are in, therefore it's all unfair. It was unfair before they won. It would have been unfair if it had gone far more away that supports my beliefs. It's still, in my opinion, would have been a bad system.
I mean, we of course, I think all of that's accurate. And how do we work to change that? I don't have the answer. What I do know is there are many things we can do that are within our power to win small victories.
Yeah.
It's like almost some people are so simplistic that you have revolution or reform.
Yeah.
When the truth is in between. You can reform to a point where a group of progressive people have such an amount of power and a stake in society that they can influence certain things. Now, obviously, revolutions happen throughout history, but they don't come out of the blue. They come out of particular sets of processes. You can't just manufacture a revolution
small
out of
victories along the way to build up. The only times a revolution will work is when there's been a learning curve to get there.
There's a great building of consciousness.
From the Battle of Algiers is it's hard to start a revolution, harder still to win a revolution. Hard to start a revolution, harder still to sustain a revolution, hardest of all to win a revolution, exactly. But it's only once we've won that the real struggle begins.
Of course.
Because that's the thing, and we saw that with the Arab Springs uprisings, all these kind of things where so many dictatorships, other things were overthrown, but then there wasn't a structure or plan to move on after that, and corruption would come in and extremism would come in and all these different things where there was this exciting uprising of the people to suddenly go, shit, we don't know what to do now. Do you know what I mean? Then that can then be exploited by the West, by all sorts of different
things. Well, it's funny because being somewhere like Zimbabwe, despite what people say, the country is far from one of the worst countries in Africa. It's far from one of the most violent. Jamaica's way more violent. Everyone loves to go there on holiday. Yeah. I don't want to give the impression that Zimbabwe is a specifically problematic country because it isn't. Like any post-colonial nation, it has its problems. But why it relates to this point is exactly that. Zimbabwe gets its independence in 1980 after military struggle. You know, it has years of kind of vacillating between having a great relationship with Britain, which it actually had up until 1997 and the land reform. And now it's sort of in a position where it is finding its feet and finding how does it move forward now that the revolution's been won. And even though this is 35 years later, it's a 35-year-old country, it's still facing that challenge as many nations in Africa and Latin America and Asia are, because running a country is not easy. I'll give the British elite their due in this sense. As much as I may disagree with a lot of their policies, a lot of the way they view the world, there are a lot of things, but stupid is not one of them. And when I look
at... They've been bred to know how to run a country.
They're a bunch of clever individuals.
It's one of the great contradictions I have with Blair is I maintain he was a fantastic politician. I don't think he was a good human.
Yeah,
I don't think he was a good prime minister, but he's one of the best pure politicians that we've had in British politics.
Absolutely, and I would say the same for Obama.
Yeah, yeah.
Despite people thinking that I should support Obama just because he's half African, Obama is a fantastic politician. I don't think he's a fantastic human. I look at his record on speaking about police brutality in America, which has been very obvious. Yeah. I look at the fact that he was willing to bomb an African country. I look at the fact that he continued most of Bush's wars. I judge the man on what he actually did, not what he said he was going to do before he came in, and I didn't get happy just because his dad's black. I look at what actually happened. But he is a brilliant politician. He's an incredibly intelligent man. He's very charismatic.
Let's talk a little on Obama then. Is your view changing at all? Because until a year or two ago, I would completely agree with you. It felt like Obama came in with all these promises and all these ideas and then just fell into line like everything else. And it's only a theory, but it feels like now he spent his first term playing the game. Do you know what I mean? The fact is, no one, in the way both of our political systems are set up, unless you're a dictator overthrowing another dictator, then it's almost impossible to come in and have complete huge change. It has to be a gradual thing. So it feels that Obama, and again, it may be to an unforgivable extent, I'm not decided on it yet, it feels that Obama came in and appeased a lot of people that were primarily against things he believed. But it now feels like he's in his final term, almost they can't touch him now, that he's making those moves with gay marriage, with the Confederate flag, with, again, just this week, I mean, this will be going out a few weeks later, but genuinely being one of the first to start to bring up the gun debate, the arms debate and things like that. And it feels that where I spent the first 4 years going, fuck this guy, he's not doing anything, I now look at it and go, well, the next a year or so will tell this, but it could be a case that he's played this game really well of spending a few years to gain his to back up his power, if you know what I mean. Because it's crazy to think that the role of President of the United States of America isn't actually that powerful a position. There's a lot of people behind that. Completely. So it feels that maybe he's built his power up there by getting the right people on side or changing things out, you know, moving things around slightly. And now he's able to go, right, we're changing the gay marriage law. His speech after, I mean, it was three shootings ago now, I think, but his speech after
one
of the
shootings... It was another one this week, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, his speech after one of them blew me away because it didn't feel like... And I'm sure it was, but it didn't feel like a president making a written statement. He kind of stood there and said, this is the eighth time I've had to do this year. Kind of, and said, like, at some point, we're going to have to admit that we're not doing it right. At some point, we're going to have to look at Australia and look at Portugal and look at other countries and go, we're not doing it right, you know. Well, so what's your feelings on him at this point, potential of him?
For me, I think that he's obviously an incredibly intelligent man.
Yeah.
And for a man of his level of education to want to be the President of the United States of America, knowing everything that entails, knowing that obviously entails overseeing murder, knowing that entails deciding who dies and lives, knowing that entails knowing certain amounts about the world and not revealing it to the public, knowing all the things that come with occupying that office, I think takes a certain type of human to even be able to do that. And I'm not passing a judgment on that because I've never been in that world. I wasn't educated at Harvard. I've never had the desire to lead a country in the current forms that countries are operated.
Yeah.
I'm fairly sure if I actually had to be the Prime Minister of Britain or the President of America or even the leader of a revolutionary Pan-African nation, I'd still have to make some pretty shit decisions.
I was going
to
say, I mean, obviously we're saying that it takes a certain kind of person to be able to do that. I think that can be a positive and a negative there, because
sure.
I have people a lot say, again, it's when I was doing a lot more political stuff, saying, why aren't you running for office or doing things like that? It's because those are jobs that's the last thing I would want to do.
It's an unenviable
such an ugly
position.
Thing. It's something that doesn't appeal to me in any way, shape or form. So.
Certainly not in its current format.
Yeah.
But I think for Obama, I think... He was never going to come in, as you said, and be able to change America from a historically racist, classist, imperialist
even more
power.
So as the first black president huge changes then.
But
it's so tough.
But I don't know, and only he can answer this because only he's in his own soul, in his own head. I am very doubtful, to be honest with you, despite all the rhetoric, that was his genuine aim. I feel that he's what we describe as centre right.
Yeah.
He's not Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He's not Ben Carson. He's not even George Bush. He's not as crazy as those people, fine. But he believes inherently in the justice of America. He believes in American exceptionalism. He believes to some degree, whether he realises or not, then as an extension of that, in the superiority of white people. What do I mean by that? America was founded on that assumption. If we believe America's so exceptional and so wonderful, there is that idea underpinning that a little bit.
Yeah.
He believes in America's right to police the world. And so he's not in line with what I believe about the way the world should run and the way things should be. Does that mean he's an inherently evil, insane, you know, psychopath? No. And does that mean everything he's going to do is bad? No. He's tried to do the Obamacare thing, as you said, with gay marriage, as you said, around the fringes of things. There's been some room for manoeuvre that he's tried to leave some degree of a positive legacy.
Yeah.
And people will judge him on that. But for me, and the way I would want to see that country move and the way I'd want to see the world move, even when there was all the euphoria. Anyone who knew me in 2008 will tell you, I was in Atlanta in 2008 and I was arguing with my cousins week in, week out. My American cousins were saying, no, you don't understand. It's been a groundswell from the people. He's going to do this. He's gonna... I was like, dude, just say that the guy's half black and that's why you're excited. And yeah. I'm fine with that. I get that. Like, I get it. You had segregation in your dad's lifetime. But to believe that him being half black means he's going to magically transform the entire society is really politically naive. But for me, what was unforgivable with Obama, just for me personally, not for anyone else, is to continue the wars that he's continued and then to be the president that oversaw NATO's bombing of Libya. For me, there's something really symbolically weird about the first African president deciding to bomb an African country and support people. I mean, we saw how they behaved. They sodomized the head of state with a knife in public. They didn't put him on trial and provide evidence and say, this is why we dislike the guy and this is why he's going to jail, or even this is why we're going to kill him. They behaved in a very vicious, disgraceful manner. They then stole the weapons that they stole. It's part of what's causing the spread of terrorism across West Africa right now. They stole weapons from Gaddafi's cache. So the consequences of the invasion of Libya, apart from destroying that country and creating the migrant crisis, have let terrorism spread all across Western Africa, wreaked all kind of havoc. And for me, whatever he does in America, however nice his legacy may or may not be for American people, that
on the global
foreign policy fuck-up, if it was even that, for me is personally unforgivable.
Yeah, I get it.
And him being quite handsome and having a lovely wife and a great family and being, you know, half Kenyan doesn't make that forgivable for me.
And
if he was a white guy, ironically, I will say this, if he was a white guy, I think we'd see that symbolically much worse. If George Bush or Bill Clinton
had done that stuff.
Well, Bill Clinton did bomb Sudan, though still a lot of people loved him because he was charismatic and he played saxophone.
Yeah.
But I think it would be easier for black people particularly to be like, hold on a minute, that's an African country, all right, albeit an Arab-speaking African country, so people may not feel as connected to it as they do to Ghana, but there's something for me very symbolic about that happening that doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah, no, I completely understand that. And it's it's really interesting how, again, you point out there that charisma and certain associations
I mean,
like
for
that...
For a politician, he's a very good-looking dude. And that does help, whether you like it or not.
I couldn't
agree
more. The fact that he's of African descent, the fact I genuinely think, and again, I was someone who was sitting there going, that's pretty cool. When he came out and said that he liked his favourite ever TV character was Omar from The Wire, I was like,
you just think that's a cool dude?
Dude's fucking cool.
He sings Al Green.
Yeah,
I get it.
It's
charisma.
An interesting one.
Charisma plays a huge role in our attraction to people, and there's no doubting he's a very brilliant man. No one's doubting he's an educated, charismatic, as I said, you know, for a politician, good-looking, smooth, great speaker. And I don't mean that in the way that when people say patronisingly he's a black guy and he speaks well. I mean full stop on any level for any group of people.
Man, yeah, he can perform.
Right, he's a performer. Yeah. He's mesmerising. No one's denying all those things. For me, I would love to have seen someone of that range of talents put that range of services to their community for justice, the way that Martin Luther King did, the way that Malcolm X did. That isn't possible for Obama, and that's fine. But for me, he won't go on the wall with those people, because I think as president of America, that is just impossible. Yeah. And I think as president of most countries, I think even if we look at Mandela, for all the fantastic sacrifice that Mandela made in the struggle against apartheid, his tenure as president of South Africa, he had to make some pretty horrific decisions. He had to make the decision to maintain basically an apartheid economy, but political apartheid decolonization, because at that point he thought that was the best he could hope for, maybe. And the legacy of that has been what? An ANC government shooting dead 34, 32 miners at Makinara in 2012, you know, striking miners. You know, they could never get away with shooting 32 white people without international outcry.
Yeah.
So you have this legacy where the same brutality is woven into the system. That's not, I'm not laying that at Mandela's doorstep. What I'm saying is even the greatest humanitarian, I met Mandela actually, I haven't spoken about this before in an interview, I don't know why. I went to his house in 2001. So my sister performed at one of his 4664 concerts then. And we went to his house, there was a big banquet. He offered my sister one of his wives. He offered my sister one of his grandsons to marry.
Amazing.
As a joke.
Yeah.
But you know, even just meeting the guy, to meet someone who's done that amount of time in jail, that still has so much love and empathy for other human beings, and he's very charismatic, really tall guy. A lot of people don't realise that. He used to be a boxer,
oh, really?
Massive guy. I mean, he's like, must be 6'4", 6'5". And just had exuded so much charisma, confidence, brilliance, love, all of that, despite everything he'd been through. Very inspiring guy, even for someone like him, being a runner of a country. And this is what I get less idealistic as I get older. Running a country is incredibly difficult. I'll give one more example. If we take Toussaint Louverture was the leader of the Haitian Revolution, the only successful slave revolution in the history of humanity. And even he, when he had won the island from the French, maintained basically a semi-slave economy. Just this time, the enslaved people got wages.
Yeah.
Because he felt that pragmatically, it wasn't possible at that point to just say, well, all these people have done all this awful stuff, slave masters talking about, let's just kick them off the island. He felt pragmatically to run a country, he still needed those people. They had the qualifications, they could run the plantations, etc. So he said, cool, you've just got to pay the people now. And obviously the enslaved people were like, what do you mean? We're not working for these same people who've been torturing us for hundreds of years. And he had to try and balance all those forces, even as someone who'd been an enslaved person himself. Yeah. Because politics is fucking complicated.
I mean, politics and I think the way we are a lot as humans, I think there's often, we're looking, when we talk of equality, we're looking up rather than around or down. So we're looking, if
you up there need to deliver these.
We're speaking of equality in the UK, for example. So many people would want that and support that. If it was then explained that equality meant you can't have that widescreen TV and your nice car.
Yeah.
If the equality is a step down, that suddenly we're like, oh shit. It's when we're looking at those above us who are all wealthy.
Absolutely.
It's similar with, I was asked to have, I was talking about having Amazon as a sponsor on the podcast at one point, and we didn't go for it in the end, but someone said to me, oh, you couldn't do that because of their tax situations. And I'm not against companies who dodge tax. I'm against the loopholes that allow them to do though, and the allow them to do so, and the political setups that allow them to do so. Because the fact is, when I was working in factories, if I could get some cash in hand work and avoid tax, I would.
I think it's because they're doing it on a bigger scale.
It's a natural thing. So it's always that thing of looking up. If we're looking up and saying we need to stop these companies dodging tax on this huge scale, it's like, well, that's okay as long as you are willing to never do that as well. I think it's a natural thing to want to cut corners or whatever else.
But it's also whether you believe in who you're paying tax to.
Yeah.
I lived in a country where I genuinely believed in the principles of my government,
yeah,
I'd queue up to pay my tax.
Yeah.
Like, if I lived in a country that was a progressive, socialist-leaning, pan-African government committed to, you know, the unity of humanity, but obviously the defeating of racism and sexism and classism. I lived in Thomas Sankara's Burkina Faso. Yeah. As hard as that would have been for me, you know, I mean, this is a guy, for those who don't know about Thomas Sankara, this is a guy who so refused to be corrupted that he traded in all of the government vehicles for shitty little Renault Clios.
Amazing.
I mean, can you imagine the elite of a post-colonial African society going to parliament in miniature Renault Clios?
Yeah, yeah, that's amazing.
He was one of the first openly feminist leaders of any country in the world as a man. Yeah. He instituted a thing called Women's Day, where men had to do all the housework, cooking, the cleaning, do all the traditionally kind of female jobs, had women in the army, you know, done so much to balance up the country. He was obviously killed because the leader of that, he was killed by a French puppet called Blaise Compaoré, who stayed in power until last year. It was only taken out of power last year. And so I think if you're in a country that you believe in, and I don't even say that just for progressive people.
Yeah.
If I was an Etonian educated Oxbridge graduate, to be honest with you,
if you believed in it,
I'd probably think Britain was the most infallible, most fantastic. And to be honest, I can't even be judgmental of people in that. If that's what you're born into, for you, this is absolutely fantastic. Even for me, right, as a person of Jamaican origin, I wasn't even born in Jamaica.
Yeah.
Despite the horrific violence, despite the homophobia, despite the shortcomings, there are elements of Jamaican culture I'm extremely proud of.
Yeah.
And it's the same even with the UK. It's just the arrogance that gets on my nerves. No one's saying Britain doesn't have anything to be proud of. If we talk about Shakespeare or Isaac Newton or elements of the Industrial Revolution or the progressive traditions I spoke about earlier, this history of poetry, there are so many things. Even if I think about when we say small victories, it's not even a small victory. When we think about how accessible much of this city is now, and there's still a lot of work to be done, so I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying it's all done. But the fact that this country is now so much more accessible to disabled people.
Yeah.
That it's abnormal to get on a bus or go in a public place where there's not a disabled toilet, where there's not a platform. Something I, as an able-bodied person, wouldn't even have thought about.
Yeah.
So there are many ways in which a country is not one thing. Just because there are structural ideas of classism and racism doesn't mean there can't be elements that transcend them. And to me, I think you can be proud of your country and also critical. And this is one of the things I think a lot of particularly right people on the right are not very good at. They think that, you know, people often say to me, and this obviously it's just silly people being racist, but they're like, if you fucking hate it here so much, why don't you go home, wherever home's supposed to be? I mean, I was born here.
Yeah, yeah.
What they really mean is, I don't believe in democracy for you.
Yeah.
So you're not allowed to be critical of the government. You know, other people are, but you're not. You should just be grateful to be here. And I find that ironic because Peter Tosh and Bob Marley spent most of their life criticising the Jamaican government and criticising the shortcomings of Jamaican politics. Did that mean, by extension, that they hated Jamaica?
Exactly.
Of course not.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think the key to, again, it keeps going in circles, but it goes back to that of it being okay to question your own, still be proud of
your
country.
And yourself.
But yeah. Well, I mean, I've lost where I was going to drift back to, but yeah,
I don't know,
that is
art.
Yeah, we should
life.
Get to music.
Yeah,
arts
we've done.
At some
we've
point.
Done. I feel like we've put the world to rights.
We've almost.
What are you listening to at the moment? Anything?
I'm listening. Oh no, that's one. The one thing I wanted to get in. I've pulled it back now.
Go ahead.
Just when you were speaking of you'd have more passion to pay tax into a system that you believed, or
not that
money.
I don't pay my taxes.
Yeah, obviously,
I do. I don't
you need
go
to get
prison.
That clear on there.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, of course.
It made me think of I'd Killer Mike on the podcast, yeah. And he was saying some stuff that I'd never even considered, because we talked about the responsibility of rappers and people that are coming from a certain atmosphere or scene or society and marketing themselves off that to then put back into that society or help.
If you're marketing yourself off the ghetto, you owe the ghetto.
The great thing that Killer Mike was saying is, like, I ain't talking about a charity. He's like, I've opened a chain of barbershops now. I've got three barbershops. I'm still being an entrepreneur. I'm still making money, but I'm employing locally.
Exactly.
I'm building things that are in my community.
Exactly.
And when I get my merch done, I get it made locally. You know, so it's that thing of, it doesn't even have to be this responsibility to be a nice guy. It's like, still go out and be a baller. But do it in a way that benefits your specific area in society,
fair.
Right?
Well, this is the thing. I was having this argument with someone the other day. We tend to, and I don't want anyone to take this as me saying capitalism is the final and best system of human governance, because, of course, that's not what I think. But I was saying we sometimes scapegoat capitalism in a way that is naive. What do I mean by that? We use capitalism to excuse human greed and human wankerishness.
Yeah.
There is no reason why a company that makes 14 billion profit a year can't say, you know, we're just going to make 12 and we're going to pay our workers well and we're not going to have any worker suicide.
Yeah.
There's no reason for that. That isn't capitalism. That's psychopathy, right?
Yeah.
And that's
couldn't
my
agree
thing.
More. Even, I've got no issue with someone having slightly nicer stuff than me because they work harder than me. And that's fine. If I choose to not do, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That level, yeah. it's not that structure as such that is the problem. It's then, again, the corruption of it, the over-greed, the over.
It's a particular,
that
I mean,
system.
Even if we look at, say, Scandinavia and Japan versus Britain and America and to an increasing degree parts of Europe, we're talking about even within capitalism, there's neoliberal capitalism, there's imperialist capitalism, and then there's what you have in Scandinavia, which is kind of socialist-leaning, relatively socially engineering, relative equality, and the same in Japan. And no coincidence, those countries have the lowest crime rates, high spread of wealth. They also have pretty high suicide, but hey, people say that's because of the weather.
Yeah.
I suppose the point I'm making is, whatever the system is, you don't have to be a total wanker, even if you're successful. You can pay your workers fairly, you can still make a profit. Like, people choose not to do those things because they're insanely greedy.
Yeah.
Not because not every company
it's
operates.
It's easy to find examples of why these things are bad, whereas ignoring, again, Hitler came to power under a democracy.
Of course.
Do you know what I mean? It's like
exactly.
So saying that democracy is the way and every other version
everything
of
he did was
democracy
legal.
Is wrong.
Yeah,
it's like,
he was elected.
No, there's times where communism is bad. There's elements of communism that is fucking amazing.
Absolutely.
You know, there's really, but because they're the Russian evil at that point, it's
of
like
course.
Communism's evil. And it's like, no, there's many different systems that could work. And that's what annoys me and was annoying me during the election was everyone was discussing
from
the
within.
Few options rather than what if we think outside of democracy. And again, I'm not saying that's an easy thing, but there's even just different kinds of democracy. If you look at like Athenian democracy and all sorts of other things.
Or India, which has like 7 million parties.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even Australia, when it suddenly had their kind of, it was split and they had to divide everything up and have a shared government, essentially. Yeah, that causes some problems. But again, these are options that are available and should be a viable thing.
I think this arrogant kind of attitude that we have the answer because we're quote-unquote Great Britain and we know everything,
yeah.
We're going to really get bitten in the arse in the 21st century.
Yeah.
We live in a world where China is returning to its position. Everyone talks about the rise of China. For 17 of the last 20 centuries, China was the richest, most technologically developed country in the world. All that's happening is business as usual.
Yeah.
It's not the rise of China. It's the return of an ancient superpower that has been a nation for 2,500 years.
Completely.
Get used to it. Go and learn some Mandarin. So this idea that we're so special is a very dangerous idea. And in many ways, actually, the irony of it and the comedy of it is for the same elite that think they can keep perpetuating this idea. I want to see how they're going to do that and manage it with the fact that the money is increasingly going to be in Asia. The fact where they're increasingly going to have to learn to do business with people who look different from them as equals.
But we're going to realise the size of our island very soon. And the fact is that because of the way we stretched out, because of some technology advances or industrial advances and things like that, we were allowed to be, or we were able to be far bigger than we necessarily are. Yeah. But the fact is, we're getting to a point now where the world is starting to come down to how much space you've got and how many people you've got as well.
Yeah.
That's going to start to influence the power.
But already the world
we're going to have to learn that.
Yeah, the world we live in is unrecognizable from the world I was born in.
Yeah.
I was born in a world where a few countries on the earth still practiced formal apartheid. Arguably one does, but generally, or two, you could say. No, many actually practice apartheid against women, but that's another discussion.
Yeah, sure.
But obviously you have the Israel-Palestine conflict, you have what's going on in South Africa, which is formal, but what I'm saying is, which is informal. What I'm saying is, even to when I was born, my younger brother is now doing Mandarin, GCSE.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Right. That was unimaginable in 1983. And so I think that, for me, the way the world's going to change over the next, 30 or 40 years, the countries that are going to do best, the space, human spaces that are going to do best, are going to be those that are that most open-minded and most prepared to adapt to change. And what I see, in many ways, I don't know if it's something to even be depressed about, what I see is a kind of ossified, old boy, Oxbridge attitude that for now, as long as Britain still has power and as long as Britain's still one of the most wealthy, most militarily capable countries in the world, and as long as we're still America's, I don't know if partner's even the right word, that arrogance can continue. But actually, there's a more innovative way of approaching the world. And there's a more innovative way of approaching debate, even if I was watching Question Time last night. And every time I watch, they've asked me to be on a few times. It's never been the right subject, right?
I've had the same. I've talked my way out of Question Time numerous times. But it's like, no, this isn't.
It's like the parameters of debate, as you were saying earlier, have already been set. And it's like someone needs to go on there and just come out of the parameters completely and say, hold on a minute. All of the basic assumptions that left, right and centre are all agreed upon on this might not even be correct.
Yeah.
Right, all of these things. About 50 times last night, people mentioned Russia and the nuclear threat. And no one said, but hold on a minute, which is the only country on earth to use nuclear weapons on human beings? Is it Russia or is it our ally?
Yeah.
Now, does that mean that, this kind of history of geopolitics in Britain and Europe and the way in which Russia and Germany and France and Britain have contested power on this small peninsula of a continent over the past, 500-600 years isn't something to bear in mind and the legacy of that. No. But the fact is only one country on earth has ever used nuclear weapons on people, and that's America.
Yeah.
And so if any country on earth should not be allowed nuclear bombs, it should be the country that currently has the most.
And again, it's the backwards argument of they say, oh, the nuclear deterrent. But the fact is they say we'd only use nuclear bombs if something was used against us or we were under threat. It's like, well,
you wouldn't be able to.
Number one, you wouldn't be able to, but number two, it would prove that the nuclear deterrent hasn't worked. So your theory of we need to keep them for a nuclear deterrent means that the only time we'd use them is when the deterrent hasn't worked anyway, so it's a backwards.
People might be surprised by me saying this. But ironically, now that the world has got to the stage where nuclear weapons exist, I wonder if the only way we're actually going to get peace, ironically, is when loads of different... I mean, people spoke yesterday about nuclear deterrent. I mean, Pakistan gets droned pretty often, right? And they have nuclear bombs. But the... Because someone mentioned on it yesterday, oh, Ukraine got rid of their nuclear bombs and look what happened. Well, I was like, Pakistan has nuclear bombs. They still get droned. But are we going to approach a stage in world affairs where there'll be 6 or 7 huge power blocks, all economically capable, all with huge militaries, all with nuclear weapons, And ironically, even though the intention was never for peace for all of that, that there'll be so much rivalry and the blocks will be so huge and there'll be so much mutually assured destruction that that will be the closest we'll get to some form of peace. As kind of morbid as that sounds, that seems more likely from where we're stood than actual genuine revolutionary, you know, love and peace in the world. Yeah. If Latin America and Africa, for example, you know, and particularly for Africa and parts of Asia, were more economically developed, were militarily stronger, had nuclear weapons to defend themselves, things like Libya might not have happened. I don't know. But there would be a different attitude towards those nations. And would that... Adam Smith, ironically, who I don't agree with on a lot of things, as you can imagine, this was one of the things he talked about.
Right.
Saying that a point, he believed a point in history was going to come where even the savage nations, I believe was the word he used, will develop to such a stage that a natural equilibrium will be found. And in some ways, that's what we're seeing between America and China.
Yeah.
We're seeing two nations that are so interdependent, that are so colossal, that have so much influence over the globe, neither of whom can afford war with one another, I would hope. Though, obviously, America's talking about its pivot to Asia, Japan's rearming. There's all this kind of danger going on that suggests a conflict might come. Hopefully, it will not. And will it be that the relative peace that humanity gets might just come out of actually the very same power-hungry lunatics around the world just all getting to such a point where they don't, where no one group has the power to dominate the other? And of course,
no one can outmuscle anyone. But it's a tough one. It's a tough one when Britain and America exist, and our great histories are based on an illusion of superiority.
Of course.
So I'd be shocked if there was a point where together we ever thought that we were, everyone was on a level.
But if,
you know,
if
what I mean?
What I mean is, if kind of the Anglo-American Empire's continuation means the destruction of all of humanity, what is then the scenario? Are there people that are that crazy they'd rather destroy the whole Earth than exist in a multipolar world? Maybe.
I'm not even saying that's
impossible.
Yeah.
It is possible. We have the technology to destroy everything ever created on this planet. Maybe that's what we'll do.
It's crazy that that's something that humans created, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That humans have sat down at some point and given ourselves the ability to destroy every living thing on the planet.
That's the way we've used some of the best minds.
That's something that we've done. That's something that we've sat down and decided, here's
a good idea. So I don't know what the future holds. I hope that to some degree or other, there is a multipolar world. I hope that Africa and Asia and Latin America develop to a point where they can no longer be bullied and have their resources taken cheaply and where they can be protected. But then that won't solve all the exploitation in the world. There'll still be classism. There'll still be sexism. There'll still be forms of injustice and expropriation. We might just have got rid of the biggest global forms of imperialism, but that doesn't mean we're going to click our fingers and everything's going to be wonderful, because I haven't spotted any point in the last 5,000 years of history that I've been studying for quite a while where there was a class-free, perfect, non-hierarchical, technologically developed, materially rich society.
Yeah.
I'm yet to find that. Will it ever exist? I don't have the answer. I'd like to hope and dream, and maybe it will always maintain, be a hope, a fleeting illusion that we chase. But at least in the chasing of that, we might manage society a little better.
It's the chasing of that, and not that I'd subject to the idea of fantasism, but it feels that a lot of the solutions to big problems in the past have turned out to be things that we had no concept of 10 years before. The speed at which we are evolving technologically, there could be solutions that aren't even fathomable at this stage. But there's a good chance not. I mean, we're almost at 90 minutes and we've not touched up on music, so I'm going to happily go over and get into some...
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's talk about your kind of, your musical upbringing. You're getting into music. You touched upon travelling out and meeting and Nelson Mandela with your sister. For anyone who doesn't know, your sister is Miss Dynamite, who smashed it has been smashing it for many years. Yeah. Were you both always into music and coming up in creating together, or was there a certain amount of inspiration from your sister?
Well, what happened was, so when we were really young, like 8, 9, 10, that sort of age. She's older than me, 2 years older than me. My stepdad ran the Hackney Empire Theatre. He was a stage manager there.
Oh, wow.
My real dad was a sound system DJ. And so every year, people know this probably from my music. We didn't have a whole load of money growing up. So we used to put on shows for my mum every year on her birthday.
Yeah.
Her birthday's in June. And so through doing that, we would put on like acting, rapping, dancing, singing shows. Believe it or not, I used to try and sing. I'm a bloody awful singer. I used to try and dance. I'm a bloody awful dancer now. I used to be an amazing dancer when I was a kid. I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
And so we kind of came into performing arts, even though we were physically and economically quite poor, culturally we were quite rich. We spent 5 days a week in the Hackney Empire. This was at a time when there was fantastic programming on there. It was easily Britain's best kind of African Caribbean-led theatre in that period. I saw Angela Davis there. I saw KRS-One lecture there when I was a kid. Amazing. I saw Sarafina, fantastic play about apartheid, come there. You know, so I was really exposed to a lot. And so growing up, Naya, as she is to me, my older sister, didn't... She was pursuing singing, but I don't know if that's what she wanted to do full-time quite yet. Then she started emceeing on Raw FM, Underground Garage station. Yeah, I was always rapping.
Yeah.
And I was playing for West Ham at the time. I played football for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And I played football for longer than 4 years, but I was at West Ham for 4 years. And then Boo came out, and it just changed. Even when I first heard it, I remember hearing the first unmixed version on a dub plate in Camden Palace. And even as an unmixed, weird sounding, the mix was all wrong, the test press was all wrong, you still just knew that something weird had been created. And then obviously I was with her going around the country as like, you know, semi-bodyguard status with her managers who were kind of not managers, they were kind of manned them from the ends who had taken up as manager. And, they did what they could do. And we just went around.
The manager role was a great nondescript one to bring in. I'm managing, all right? Just don't question.
So we just went around the country, you know. I went around the country with her, watching Boo explode. Obviously, I was there when, you know, she won Mercury and the Brits and MOBO and all that. And it was inspiring, but it was also a lesson for me. You know, I was 17 when I went to the MTV Awards. We were in Barcelona. And I went to Puff Daddy's after party. And very early, I realised... this world isn't for me.
Right.
You know, I saw all these kind of celebrities on all kinds of drugs. You know, I won't name no names, but, you know, I saw all kinds of madness. And I was just like, well, I realised very early, even at 17, I wasn't impressed by the glitz and the glamour, which was a strange thing to learn of yourself at age. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'd been around. It's funny because even though I grew up poor, I'd been around a bit of money. And a few of my friends were footballers. A few of my friends were not footballers, but had money. You know, they were into the wrong stuff. So at 15 and 16, I'd been in Range Rovers and BMW convertibles and Mercs this and Mercs that. I'd been in the club around champagne and blah, 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 and showing off. I had a £500 Avex coat, you know. Yeah. I'm not saying I was a baller because I wasn't that either, but I'd been around people that had lots. Even if they were still kind of didn't have lots and they lived at home with their mum.
Yeah.
And then obviously what happened with my sister happened, but it made me realise I wanted to do things differently and I wanted to try and build a business that was based on and a music career that was not based on doing as I was told by a record label. And in many ways, my sister inspired that because at 19 years old, when she finished her first album and the label told her Miss Dynamite had to be the first single, she just told them, no fucking way. I want It Takes More to be the first single.
Yeah.
I want to come out with a song that's about something. It means the label didn't want to do it. She's like, I don't give a fuck. I'm not filming any other video. So it's up to you what you want to do. And she had this kind of ballsy, not give a fuck attitude at 19 years old, 20 years old. So Solid asked her to join So Solid when she was much younger and they were in a much more commanding position than she was. This was just around the time Boo was about to come out. And she was like, no, you're all right. Like, safe, Mega, we're cool in that.
Yeah.
But I want to do my own thing. I don't want to be under your wing. At the time, So Solid were the biggest thing in the country.
Yeah, yeah.
So in many ways, Naya had a kind of do-it-yourself mentality, even though she was on a major label. And that inspired me. And I was lucky enough that, you know, some investors came in. It's not like they invested 10 million quid in me, you know, but they put up some money so I could film some videos and we started this company. And 10 years later, here we are. You know, first album came out in 2006. It'll be 10 years next year. And it's weird because I've gone the proper long way about it, but we're now in a position where I can tour around the world, where I can sell, you know, 10,000-15,000 live tickets a year in the UK without really releasing a single.
I
toured in March. I'm going to tour again in November. And it's weird because the urban scene is such a strange thing that you have hype and you have success. And sometimes people have both. You know, some people have hype and success.
Sometimes people only have one or the other. I mean, it's one of the things I saw because when I was coming up, again, we'd done it all so independently, weren't particularly part of any scene.
Yeah.
And it would surprise me to see people that I perceived as being up here, like the hype I'd heard about, and then seeing them struggling to sell out a two, th- a 300.
People don't realize how hard it is to get people to come and pay to see you.
Exactly that.
It's a challenge.
The way because we'd done it quite independently, but we'd grinded it out. We'd built this live following that meant we could sell out 2,000-3,000 caps. And it's like, shit, there's people who perception, because they're on a bigger label, perception would say these guys are huge. And it's like, well, actually, you know, it's
real
times versus real, you know,
a strong fan base. And it especially for, you know, within UK hip hop, I remember when I was in school, the idea that you could have a career as a UK rapper just seemed bloody ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because everyone
it was a competition with other people you knew rather than to be on this aspiring thing. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so in many ways, I'm kind of like, fucking hell, like, even though I always expected to quote unquote succeed, in many ways, people always ask me, even supporters of mine, but you should be so much more well known, your music's this, blah, blah, blah. Don't you get pissed off? And I think people expect me to say yes. But no, I really couldn't give a shit. You know, I do what I love for a living every day. If I don't want to get out of my bed tomorrow, I don't have to.
Yeah.
And to me, that's enough. I don't need to be a multimillionaire. You know, I'm comfortable. I have a nice car. I live in a nice house. I have probably 3,000 books in my library. You know, I travel all over the world. I don't need to drive a Rolls Royce to feel good about myself. And I'm not knocking anyone that even does. I'm just saying that for me, I feel comfortable. And I also feel comfortable in the trajectory. It might take me another 5-6 years to get to a level where people generally think, I see what you've been doing all these years. Yeah. But I think enough people kind of get it. And I think that also, you know, just it's I just feel very lucky and I feel very blessed because I've been able to maintain that independence for so long. And still have a viable career. And really, that all comes down to the supporters. 100%. And it comes down to people that are willing to kind of stay with you if they believe in what you do and they like what you do. Definitely. But I also think it's about diversifying as an artist. What's great about this time that we live in is being able to do a bit of theatre, write a graphic novel, you know, do a lot of the education work I do, to have a broad range of things that you do so that you are constantly evolving as an artist and a performer and not be boxed in.
Definitely. I mean, I definitely want to talk more on the theatre front, but I also want to just highlight and agree with what you were saying there about your sister choosing the single that she wanted to be the first single. I think I've had this argument in the past, and I ended up doing it on my solo record, and then we ended up doing it on our last record with me and Dan, and my argument was always, right, if this is the song that the label think is going to blow everything up, then let me put the one that I think should be first, because it should make a difference. Do you know what I mean? If you think no one's going to care about this, then cool, because the people that are already there, I want them to know that this is what I'm about.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? This other one might be the more poppy or the more commercially accessible, but I want my people at first to know this
secure
is what I'm about.
Secure what you already have.
Yeah.
Because people will go away from you if you feed them shit they don't like.
My argument, or my example of that, is always a Kendrick Lamar, and it's turned around a bit now, but when Drank, I can't think of what the actual name is. Swimples, that's right. When that came out, if you listen to that, that's a conscious hip hop track. Mm. That's talking about alcoholism and the troubles of it. Now,
you know, I've never even listened to it like that.
But that's it. Yeah. I played it on my radio show when I had a show on XFM, and a lot of people were like, why are you playing this commercial hip hop or whatever? I was like, if this was my song, you'd have paid more attention, because you're expecting it to be more conscious. Yeah. You'd have listened to the lyrics a bit more and heard this. But because it's someone you see as just commercial rap, you're not paying attention to the
That's very possible, because I've never even noticed that myself.
The bits in it, or genuinely, it's great in that way. But and that's what I mean. If your sister had come straight out with the more poppy one, then people would have gone, fuck.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? She's gone pop. Yeah. Whereas if she's come out first going, it's cool.
Here's my thing.
It's all right to hear what's coming next, because this is poppier, but you know, it's you'll listen to it that bit more and get the intricacies of it.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? But let's talk about a theatre, because that's as huge a part as anything in your career, I'd say, really now.
Yeah,
from going down the spoken word route to going down, putting on plays and putting together production companies and the whole thing.
So we are, at the moment, we did our last tour. So the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company is a music, theatre and education company that I launched in 2009, officially. And obviously it was really interesting because Sam McKellen came to our launch workshop, and that created a bit of kind of fury. He was really cool, to be honest with you. He really worked well with the kind of local young people. was really not, even though he had his preconceptions of hip-hop. He said he was trying to bring Patrick Stewart to the workshop too, but Patrick Stewart just hates hip-hop. Because he hates what he thinks is hip-hop, right? He's probably never listened to a Saul Williams or a Gil Scott-Heron or any of the stuff that he might...
Just as a footnote, the first time I saw you was supporting Saul Williams at the Scala.
Oh, there you go.
Like early, mid-2000s.
That must have been 2006.
Yeah, or 2006. Yeah, it was right at the start.
Wow, there you go. Yeah, so I did do that support for Saul. Saying was really cool. And so the aim of Hip Hop Shakespeare, our last tour was Richard II. We'll probably be touring that again in the spring. And what we actually did was we took Richard II. I took that play because it's, quite frankly, a bit of a fucking boring play.
Yeah.
But there's like five bits of incredible writing in it. There's a scene with John O'Gaunt. There's two or three great speeches. And so we took the bits that we loved and then we rewrote the rest as concept.
Yeah.
As songs, basically. So we created this concept album, like a gig, literally like a live band gig of a Shakespeare album with theatrical acted elements in between it. And we deliberately toured it in music venues. We went to all the Academy venues, the smaller ones. And that's the way we started to build a live following for that. And now we're going to put that on again next year.
Again, the great thing there is taking it to music venues because it's easy to get funding and support again from the middle classes and upper classes when you're putting anything that they see as urban in theatres, in these art spaces or whatever. But the key there is taking it where the people that you're trying to reach are going to hear it, where people from areas that you grew up in are going to come out and hear it and give it a look and pay attention to it rather than just going, oh, isn't this nice that we're doing this diversion?
I think you can sort of do both. And that's what we've tried to do. I've done stuff at the South Bank Centre
where I
got this lecture format I do called Hip Hop History. And it's a way I use hip hop to tell the history of the African diaspora. And last time I did it at South Bank, 2,500 people came. Amazing. Granted, it was free, but it was like, even I think for the South Bank, they were like, rah, like we've never had, and look where it is, it's on the South Bank. It's 2 minutes from Elephant and Castle or Brixton.
Yeah, completely.
And so you had such a range of people, and I think a lot of the time we don't give our audience enough credit. We don't think audiences are intelligent enough and sophisticated enough and real enough to like... We've done shows, this is more for Hip Hop Shakespeare than me, because my stuff's a lot more aggressive in what it's saying.
Yeah.
But we've done shows where there's been 75-year-old people there and 4-year-olds there, and everyone's enjoyed themselves. And our mission... As much as it's about spreading education, re-educating people about hip-hop, re-educating people about Shakespeare and just poetry in general, it's also about looking at innovative and interesting ways in which the stage can be used in the 21st century, the way we can create something new and unique to London, the way we can add a new voice to hip-hop, the way we can change the dialogue around Shakespeare being seen as this dusty old guy that died 400 years ago that's got nothing relevant to say, when in his time, the vast majority of people that went to see him were illiterate. Were people that couldn't read or write, and were people that were significantly poorer than anyone who lives in England today. And so, really, those are a lot of the things we are trying to do across film, across TV, and on the stage. And then I did my first one-man theatre show this year at a place called the Dissenters Chapel, just up in Kensal Green, called The Knowledge Seeker's Journey, which was a one-man, sort of esoteric, long-form poem journey show thing, again, which I'm trying to adapt. And that's part of my development process to turn in my graphic novel, which I'll give you when we finish, a copy of The Ruins of Empires. I'm trying to turn that into a full-scale, big theatre production. And so that is part of that development. Also, I've been working on an EP with a producer called Prashant Mistry. And that is a, for want of a better word, an audio book, really. It's produced music, but it's me reading short stories over a collection of produced beats, soundscapes, songs. We might release that late this year. We might release it early next year. Not decided yet.
Is there plans to do that as a live...
Yeah, it's called A Conversation with Freedom. We'll probably do that as a separate live thing from a regular Akala tour. And then we have... Next year, spring, will be the 10th anniversary of my debut album. Yeah. So I'm going to put...
Amazing.
I've never put most of my music on vinyl.
How's that feel to be 10 years in the
game? It's mad.
10 years in the game.
It's mad. 10 years in the game and still here. So I'm gonna do like a vinyl. I don't want to call it a greatest hits because obviously I haven't had any hits technically. You know, I've had kind of cult hits with my group, but I've never been in the charts in that way. Yeah. So I'm going to do a best of the last 10 years on vinyl. So that's people wicked. Watch out for that. And you know, those are all kind of, like I said, just feel blessed to be here, still feel very blessed to be making music, you know.
Amazing. So where can people keep up to date on all of this? I mean, the good thing about this podcast, I mean, we put it on iTunes and everywhere else, but we also do it with an app called Acast. Mm-hmm. And again, it's part of this whole my feeling of the of podcast and app being the future of technology mm-hmm. is we tag everything as we're going along. So mm-hmm. while you were talking about a hip-hop Shakespeare, if they'd wanted, they'd click and they're on the Hip-Hop Shakespeare website. Mm-hmm. And all these different subjects and topics that we've discussed, if you want to look down, you've got that. As brilliant. We were saying earlier, the fact is there's so much information out there, but a lot of people are too lazy to look for it. That's one of the dope things about the podcast revolution with things like Acast is that you can cut that laziness out. You can say, right, we were talking about the Arrow Springs earlier. Even if it's just the Wikipedia page explaining what the fuck that term means or what that was, then here we go. So, yeah, that's kind of exciting. But where can people
keep up to date with Twitter.
Everything you...
You know, I post to my Facebook stuff that I'm doing, life questions, different things go on my Facebook. But I'll be honest, if you people message me on Facebook and if you don't get a response, don't be upset. Just if I were to... I'm not going to get someone from the office to respond to a personal fan message. I think that's a bit bad. They might, you know, send a generic email here or if there's something particular they pick out, but I can only keep up with one social network full time. Otherwise, that would be all I did. Twitter, if someone responds to you on Twitter, that is me responding to you. I don't let anyone else
can
use
I find
my Twitter.
You on Twitter.
So Twitter is at Akala Music. Yep. So is Facebook, so is Instagram. But Facebook and Insta, if you want to actually message me, I wouldn't do that on there so much.
Yeah.
I would do it on the Twitter. Get at me on Twitter is best. But check out the Facebook and the Insta for where I'm touring or what I'm doing and blah, blah, blah. But really, Twitter is the one social network that I kind of use.
Perfect. Well, I mean, we've gone a well over the normal amount, and I think we're going to have to do another one down the line at some point, 100%. Because it's been great fun. But thank you very much for making the time.
Anytime. Big
cheers, man.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was, as said, two specials this week. And we will put the Drunk Cast out probably this week as well. I'll get round to that. But for now, there's the two. Yeah. Thank you for tuning in. And as said, support people in any way you can in these times. Stay safe and see you all soon. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.